I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The impeachment hearings have consumed the media's attention for months, but media bias has led to multiple versions of the same story, and we're caught in the middle. Today we'll talk with the media critics about that and which 2019 stories didn't get the attention they deserved. Then, we discuss how Kansas City became the adoption hub of America. Of the over 100,000 pregnant, unwed young women who came here, 35,000 found their way to the Waldorf of maternity hospitals to have and give up their babies. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In our highly politicized culture these days, the media has had its hands full covering the impeachment of President Trump. On one side of the aisle, they're saying over and over again that the whole thing was a joke, that this was the weakest impeachment case in history. The other side said the evidence was indisputable and that the president had committed the equivalent of high crimes and misdemeanors. So how good of a job has the press done in sorting through all this? And what are the consequences when two versions of something as serious as impeachment are presented to the public? Our media critics are here to run all this down. They are Peggy Lowe, who's a reporter for KCUR. Peggy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Steve Volgas is the night chair at the William Allen White School of Journalism over at KU. Steve, good morning to you.
Morning, Steve.
If you want to join our conversation, our number here this morning, 816-235-2888. But first off, I want to touch on a different story that's breaking today. National news, obviously a buzz today with talk about an assassination in Iraq of an Iranian general. It was carried out by American drones, and it got us wondering about the role of the media in situations like these. We've invited Dr. Rebecca Best in to talk about this. She's a political science professor at UMKC, and she specializes in the Middle East. Rebecca, nice to have you again. Welcome.
Thank you.
The coverage of this story is obviously in its early stages, but so far, what do you make of what you've read?
Yeah, there's not as much coverage right now as I think we'll see as we begin to sort of get the facts. One thing that I think is really missing right now from the coverage and the conversation is what happens now in Iraq. So we've heard a lot of discussion about where the relationship between the United States and Iran goes from here, what the response is going to be from Iran, retaliation. What we haven't heard is, what does this mean for Iraq? This attack occurred in Iraqi territory where the United States does have a military presence with the permission of the Iraqis. Does this mean more conflict, potentially Iraq getting caught between Iran and the United States? What does this look like for people on the ground in Iraq right now?
So you're looking forward to seeing that coverage in the days to come.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what, does that become something that we're aware of? Does the media pick that story up? Right now, I don't think they have.
You know, I'm wondering if can media coverage have an effect on government or military leaders at home or abroad? And can it shift popular opinion at a time like this?
Yeah, I definitely think it can. So one, as I mentioned before, we're not hearing much about Iraq right now. I think what the media covers does affect how people perceive a situation, what people think is important, whether they think something is really important breaking news that might affect them or just sort of business as usual. So what's covered, I think, matters a lot, and how it's covered, how it's framed.
You wonder how much interest most Americans even have in international events these days.
Yeah, I think, I think for a lot of people, it's just overwhelming to try to keep up because, it seems like there's so much going on in places that maybe people are less familiar with. And I think that's one reason that the media coverage is really important and does have this really, strong ability to frame how people think about issues and what people think is important. Because, again, there's just so much out there. We need, I think the average American really needs the media to tell us with big headlines, what should I be worried about?
Yeah. Let me bring Peggy and Steve into our conversation. Again, as I said, Peggy, the coverage here, obviously very much in its early stages. As you've scanned the headlines on different sites, what struck you about what you're seeing?
I have a couple of things. So last night, the news alerts started coming across my phone,
right,
you know, from the Times and the Post. And so that was pretty eye-opening. I went on Twitter, and already what was trending was World War III. And Wag the Dog. Do you guys remember that movie? The David Mamet movie that is hysterical and very scary. Basically, during the Clinton administration, during the Lewinsky scandal, Clinton started some activity in the Mideast. So that was pretty interesting. I also liked what Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, said this morning on Twitter. He said that he felt like the cable news has politicians and paid in-house talking heads. NPR had actual experts, academics, and journalists. I'm sure that I am showing my own bias here, but what he said is that NPR appeared less shouty, which I liked that.
Yeah. Steve, your first reactions.
Well, it's about the same as what Peggy and Rebecca have said. We're, on the one hand, reporting what we know about the situation that's happening there, but we'll need a lot more context, particularly the confusing part of Iraq or Iran being in Iraq when this event happened, and the nature of where the journalists get our information first, as Peggy said, is it from the sort of the talking heads, the politicians, some sort of experts, and all of that looks toward where the event happened. I think if we're thinking of what local news can do, what's the next? What do we do to localize this to make it make sense to people here around Kansas City, say? And I would think, can you find people here who are from Iraq, from Iran, and talk to them to sort of, to humanize the story, for one thing, to show that this is a disagreement between governments, not between us and the people of these other two countries, and then maybe hear what they have to say about what's happening and how they feel about what happened there.
You know, I'm struck by how quickly things move these days. This event, obviously not even 24 hours old, Rebecca, and already on the New York Times, I assume on the Post, CNN already has analysis stories up talking about various aspects of this situation. Are you surprised by that, or what do you make of that part of it, that journalism has already moved into the analysis phase of its coverage?
You know, I actually am not surprised to see that there are already stories trying to analyze this, trying to sort of go with what we do know. Because, I suspect there were a number of people who saw the news last night and they stayed up all night sort of thinking about, what does this mean? You know, the fact that the United States has so publicly claimed this attack makes it impossible for Iran not to respond. And I think that, you know, that's a point that I think a lot of us saw pretty immediately, so I'm not surprised to already see some early takes on where do we go from here. I do think domestically Iran has to retaliate. They don't have an option because we have so publicly claimed this attack. We've left them no choice.
You know, Peggy, already on CNN, there are some questions being raised about the president's credibility at a time like this, pointing out that, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has pointed out that the Iranian leader who was killed was threatening American lives going forward. But Secretary Pompeo hasn't really specified exactly what kinds of threats were being posed to Americans. And so you wonder, given the track record of this administration, CNN was saying, you know, how much trust and faith can we put into the administration's thinking at a time like this?
I am actually tired of analysts suggesting that there is a strategy in place within the Trump administration, because there has been no evidence to prove that the Trump administration moves forward with any strategy. It's very seat of the pants. I would suggest that first. But secondly, to your earlier question, Steve, about context and analysis, I really like that. And I like that from, say, New York Times reporters or Washington Post reporters who have spent lots of time in that geographic area and know this. I really like, too, on NPR this morning, after each interview with, say, politicians or analysts or other experts, they bring the reporters in, the NPR reporters, to say, well, here's the context. Here's what's going mm-hmm. on. I like that. And I know, to your point, that it moves a little fast. That's true. But I think more and more we need that context today.
Steve, some listeners might wonder how it's possible for reporters from different outlets to turn around analysis pieces so quickly. Again, this event not even 24 hours old yet. How does that happen?
Well, papers like The Times, The Post, have reporters in those cities. They've been covering the politics there, the cultural affairs of those places for years and years. And some of them are reporters who move around and from one foreign post to another, so they learn the context of how countries work between one another, and others stay in the Mideast for many, many years, mm-hmm. Especially since we've had a lot of political interests, military interests in this part of the world. Now, there are some pretty large bureaus, so it's not just one person who answers the phone one morning and from the bureau or from the office in New York or Washington and has to write up a story. Mm-hmm. They're part of what's happening. They're there every day.
Rebecca, I know you have to scoot in just a moment here, but any tips you would offer our listeners who are trying to sift through these events and all their implications this morning? What would you advise people to do?
Right. So I think this is relevant to a lot of what we've been hearing lately about where we get our news and filtering through our news. So I think for people who are trying to make sense of this, who maybe don't follow this every day, you know, go to reputable news sources. Again, as always, check the date on the articles that you're reading. If something seems really extreme or strange, you know, maybe verify it with another source. So I think those are sort of the big things as people are following this to sort of watch for, and to also sort of look for maybe multiple perspectives, right? Not just American perspectives, but again, I think Peggy maybe mentioned this earlier, looking for perspectives from people who either do live or have lived in these countries, in Iraq and Iran.
And certainly the French already critical of what the Trump administration has done here today.
Yeah, certainly so looking to our European allies.
Yeah. What about this idea, Rebecca? You're a poli-sci person, so put on that hat for me before you leave us. What's the most interesting part of this assassination story to you so far?
I think there's a lot that's interesting here. I think one question that we're going to see debated a lot, that we're already seeing debated, is how much does this actually hurt Iranian capacity, military capabilities, and how much does it increase the danger for U.S. troops in the Middle East? Again, as I said before, I think we've painted Iran into a corner a little bit. They domestically, the regime in Tehran has to retaliate, has to respond to this. And I don't know that we kind of got our money's worth on this one in terms of did it further our interests? Did it increase the costs for us in the future and the danger?
I imagine when it comes to retaliation, we're going to find out pretty quickly here.
Yeah, I suspect we will.
Okay, that's Rebecca Best. She's a political science professor at UMKC. Thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking with our media critics about some issues in the news. Let's turn to another big topic these days, which is the coverage of President Trump's impeachment hearings in the House. We've had the vote, obviously, that whole controversy now shifting over to the Senate. Peggy, how difficult a job has the media had when it comes to reporting on this impeachment drama?
I think it's a very difficult job. And for the most part, I think that they've been very careful to keep it in the context of what we need to talk about, which is, you know, were there any crimes committed? And this is only the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. So that's really, really important. What I'm rather sick of in both the papers and television and even NPR is this idea that it's like this swampy sports story. Who won the day? Mm-hmm. Who had the best message? Are the Republicans on task? Now what are they going to do? I am very tired of it being placed in that kind of Washington, D.C. horse race story.
That's interesting. Steve, how about you?
It's a lot the same as what Peggy says, although I would say that the media probably is in some way put into their own corner when the people who are making the points, their sources, whether it's a congressional testimony or senators and congressmen speaking after the testimony, and they make their points in a way that is so particular and that is may not have anything to do with what we just heard as testimony presented. And how the tough thing becomes, how does a reporter call out the senator, the congressman, for just spouting some party line without herself sounding like a partisan?
And moving past the talking points is what you're suggesting.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm.
Steve, is this story more difficult to cover than any other garden variety controversy coming out of Capitol Hill, where you have Republicans firmly on one side, Democrats firmly on the other?
Yes, because of the temperature of it. It is so hot for everyone involved. Anybody who
words are being parsed more closely than ever, you're suggesting.
So words are being parsed, temperatures are higher, people are just, anyone following it seems to already have a point of view. Very few people are being swayed. So the tough line for the reporter to walk is to be able to report what happened in a way that's accurate today, but also moves the story along with a bit of additional reporting for context, and that doesn't ignore, you can't ignore the shouting, for lack of a better word, on either side.
Yeah.
You've got to report it, but you also have to show what's really going on.
You know, Peggy, it seems to me that the reporting game has changed a little bit in recent years. Reporters more aggressive about pointing out statements of fact versus mistruths and pointing that out in even basic news stories. How does that affect things, that dynamic?
I think you're right. People are, our reporters are getting better at pointing out facts and correct things. This is very hard, and this is very different given who is in the White House. And when you have a president who has 68 million Twitter followers, who is putting out disinformation on a daily basis, sometimes tens of times a day. It's a really, really difficult place for reporters. And it's the first time we're in that place. So it's been a bit rough. And I think more and more, though, it's a good sign that reporters are saying, well, actually, this is what's true. This is what's false.
But Republicans, a lot of times partisans, suggest that these are signs of media bias, media positioning against Republicans in general. Steve, is that fair?
Frankly, I don't think it is. If the point of a reporter is to attempt to get to what the truth is. Now, we rarely know what the truth is at the end of the day or at the end of reporting a piece, but that's the goal. And I think what you might be getting at is what there's this Rand report that came out on trust in media and where people get information. They refer to the deterioration of trust. And they say what that means is people are less likely to agree on what facts are or when they're presented with them to believe that they're facts in the first place, because they want to believe what they want to believe. And that's a real challenge for society and certainly for reporters. When if we believe that we're reporting as accurately and truthfully as we can, yet we're accused of having a point of view, trying to present one side or to criticize another side, then it's just really tough to push back when we can say, well, this is what the person said. Here's what we know that are the facts from this very reputable source, whether it's a government agency or academic or some other kind of study that we can all rely on.
One other poll, Steve mentioned the Rand survey, a different one from Gallup from late September, pointed out that just 41% of Americans have a great deal or a fair amount of trust in the media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly. The record low was 32% in 2016, so the media is up from that low mark. But clearly, this has taken a bite, out of the media's credibility, Peggy. I mean, that's a problem for the industry, right? It can't be ignored.
It's a huge problem. And when we're being dubbed as enemy of the people by the president, that really does paint us into a corner, to your point, Steve. And I think my New Year's resolution on that front is, when I see falsehoods on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, I want to civilly engage, which I didn't last year. I was tired of it. I was burned out by it. I just want to civilly engage and say, in fact, here's the facts. And I think that's going to be our job more and more every day.
You know, it's interesting how certain words are being parsed these days, Steve. Some conservative outlets have complained that when other outlets use the word historic to describe the impeachment vote in the House, that this was bias in and of itself because it added gravity to a situation that that the right regards as a joke. The impeachment thing was not a serious attempt to oust the president. It was an attempt to embarrass him. At least that's what many Republicans say. What do you say to that?
Well, it is historic. Whether even if it's a joke, I mean, a joke can be historic, too. I mean, think of the War of the Worlds. That was right. Entertainment, and right. It caused mass panic. So that was historic. An event doesn't have to meet everyone's checklist in order for it to be historic. It can be, you know, it's the third time. As Peggy said, right. That makes it historic in this country.
Right.
And at this point, whenever anyone opens their mouth about anything, you get to be criticized. That's mm-hmm. just how it is right now.
So when we see these two versions of impeachment being presented to the country, then what does it mean for this country? I mean, impeachment is a big deal, and yet we are split in so many ways right down the middle when it comes to how significant this moment is.
Well, you know, I guess I'm certainly no expert in American history, but looking back at the way both the press was partisan in the 19th century and has been from the beginning of the country, and how previous that the impeachment back then was reported and even discussed by politicians, you know, partisanship is nothing new. And I worry that sometimes we feel that unless everybody can agree on the same set of facts or the point of view, or we can all look at this rationally as you would if you were on a jury for some sort of civil matter, then we're in a crisis in the country. I mean, it's certainly things are not great, but it's not as if we can put partisanship aside. So I think in that context, it's not so awful that people have a point of view. And then you add to it, as others are pointing out, that impeachment is a political trial. It is mm-hmm. a political process. It is not governed by the rules of an ordinary trial. So
right.
Part of this is to be expected. But it's still, I mean, it makes me upset and anxious when I read these mm-hmm. things and try to understand it myself.
A lot of Americans are very anxious these days about a whole host of things, probably including this. Let's turn to a different topic here. The presidential primaries are almost upon us, and a study from RAND, I think you referred to it, Steve, suggests that people rarely look these days for alternative views when they consume the news. Is there any question about that, Peggy? And how concerning is that?
I think we need a lot more psychological studies on confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really don't know what else to say about that. People are now reading whatever they believe anyway, so it's very difficult to change people's minds and hearts.
If people want to make a real effort to look at alternative views during this election season, what tips would you have for them, Steve?
I like to read, when I'm looking for a different point of view, opinion pieces, but not just people like shouting heads on cable news, but a well-written piece that can present some facts and that I could look up myself if I want to,
mm-hmm.
And that uses language and rhetoric that is not explosive or fiery, but just, you know, tries to present a point of view to get me to believe it. And there are good columnists whose points of view I would otherwise disagree with, who can persuade me to look at things in a different way. So I try to avoid the idea that I think there's a false equivalency that if I read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, then I must also watch Fox to balance it out, because I think a good reporting source should be able to provide many points of view in its reporting in a single article.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not also saying you should only read the New York Times or any one source, but there should be look for reliable sources, reliable speakers, columnists who are using facts that you can look up to base their own opinions.
So you're suggesting that consumers take a more activist role in what they're consuming, that they should really think about any one article in terms of how it's presented, how it's sourced, those kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's to think critically about the information you're being given, just as you would if you're going to go buy a new car. You're mm-hmm. not going to believe just what the brochure says about how wonderful it is. Well, you shouldn't believe just any particular article for the basis of it. And that's because when a reporter is reporting, and we report that here's what this person said, or that the president or the governor or the politician. We're saying that it's a fact that the person said it. So if the politician said, my tax plan is the best and my opponent's is the worst, we're not agreeing with the politician. We're just saying that it's a fact that the politician made the claim. It's up to you, the reader or the listener, to come away with a decision about whether that politician was right or not. Hmm.
Just a final point here today. The two of you came in with two stories from 2019 that didn't get the coverage they deserved. Peggy Lowe, what did you come up with there?
I have a couple. Like you said, on Christmas morning, I heard a story on NPR. It was in the newscast about the body of a soldier coming back home. He was killed in Afghanistan. And that reminded me of the publication of the Afghanistan papers in the Washington Post, which I think is one of the most significant things since the Pentagon Papers. I mean, I think it was
an inside look at the way that war was conducted.
Right. It was a confidential trove of documents that shows U.S. officials made rosy pronouncements about the war that they knew to be false. They knew these statements were false. That was for 18 years through both Republican and Democratic administrations. I just think that was an enormous story that didn't get a lot of traction.
Right. Well, interesting.
Yeah. So, and the second one was, you know, Trump's trade tariffs playing out in agriculture. The Trump administration is spending $16 billion in direct subsidies to farmers because the tariffs didn't go well.
To compensate them for lost business because of the tariffs.
Yes, yeah. And we just didn't hear a lot about that at all.
Yeah. Steve, what did you pick?
I chose one from Kansas in the Capital Journal in Topeka. Tim Carpenter reported on a Secretary of Commerce under Governor Brownback. His name is Anthony Suave, who Tim reported had taken a trove of state data about businesses in the state of Kansas and transferred it to his own consulting business.
Wow. True confession number 106. I was not aware of that story until I read it in the notes in your pre-interview that you had talked about that. That story went right by me, too.
That's
a significant story.
It came out in May. The KBI was going to investigate. And honestly, I don't know much else about it because once the Capital Journal reported it, I just heard next to nothing. And it's not to pick on one particular politician, but you know, if people are concerned about the way the government is acting and using their own money to conduct its business, then it's something people ought to look at. My other one was the big picture question of free speech and social media. So if this is Facebook and Twitter, and what are they going to do with political ads in the upcoming campaign? Where Facebook says it should just be a level playing field. Anybody can post anything they want, and we're not going to determine if it's accurate. And more than the question of political ads, to me, it's this question of what is free speech on the internet or anywhere else. And Mark Zuckerberg seems to think that free speech just means opening it up to anybody to say what they want and let them sort of have it out as if it's some huge boxing match.
Right.
But on a platform that's limited in the sense of we can only see so many posts a day, and when take that to the next level and Facebook, through its algorithms, is determining in part what I see and what I don't see, then there really isn't free speech there.
That's interesting. We'll have to leave our conversation there with our very good media critics. That was the voice of Steve Wolgast, the night chair at the William Allen White School of Journalism over at KU. Peggy Lowe also joined us. She's a reporter from KCUR. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Steve.
After a short break, we'll come back and talk about the time when Kansas City was the adoption hub of America. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you resolve to become more informed this new year, make things easy on yourself and go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. You'll get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from yours truly. Sign up now. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. For Monday's program, a preview of the upcoming Missouri General Assembly session and the issues that could be on the legislative table. And when it comes to the 2020 election, how will it influence lawmakers? That's on Monday's Up to Date here on KCUR. Well, it was called the Willows Maternity Sanitarium, and it was the place in Kansas City where young, unwed girls went to give birth to their babies. The girls were often disgraced and ostracized, and the Willows gave them the privacy they needed to move forward in their lives. Turns out that more than 100,000 young women came to Kansas City to give birth, and the city had the reputation at the time as the adoption hub of America. That was due in part to its central location location where the train network of the country converged. The Willows was right up the street from Union Station at 2929 Main Street. It's no longer there, but you can imagine the trepidation that so many girls experienced walking into that home for the first time. Kelly Parr of Manhattan, Kansas, has written a new book about the Willows titled Mansion on a Hill. His mother was born at the Willows in 1925, and Kelly was able to unite mother and daughter in 1991. Kelly is also the author of My Little Valentine that talks about their reunion after 66 years. Kelly, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
When did you first find out that your mother was born at the Willows?
We pretty much always knew, our family did, that she was born at the Willows because she had received her adoption papers when she was 18. Mm-hmm. And there was a letter from the Willows from Mrs. McEwen telling my grandparents they had a daughter available. So my mother had always known.
Did she talk about it very much?
It was a big issue for my mother. She didn't talk about it a lot, but she always had this burning desire. She wanted to know more about her birth mother. She never talked about the Willows itself. We never really knew anything about the Willows other than that one letter, but she always wanted to know more about her birth mother. She had a wonderful family. She just didn't want to hurt their feelings, but she always wanted to know.
You know, back in 1991, you were able to unite your mother with her birth mother. How did that come about?
Well, it was, I've always said it was either a divine intervention or just plain good luck. My mother had always searched throughout her lifetime and had never had any luck because of the laws being so that she couldn't get her original birth certificate. In 1991, she gave copies of all of her adoption papers to my sisters and me. And I was doing some searching at the Historical Society in Topeka for my class. I was teaching third grade. And in the process, I learned how to search in their microfiche. And my mother was born in Missouri, but she was raised in Kansas.
Right.
We never knew. We always assumed she was, her mother was from Missouri. But I happened to think, well, what if she was from Kansas? So I started to look in the state census, and I found the last name that we had in a small town in southeast Kansas. And they
Independence, Kansas, right?
Independence, Kansas, right.
So you did some research. You figured out, put two and two together.
Right.
Tell us about the first meeting between your mother and her and your grandmother.
It was pretty incredible. I always say it's kind of was those that Oprah moment.
Yeah.
Where my mother had always wanted to look or find her. And so when I finally told her, she didn't know that I was looking or that I had contacted her. So when her mother, correct. And so when I was able to reach her, I actually had called her and my grandmother and told her that my mother had been looking for her, and she was quite open to having us be a part of her life. She lived in California. So when I went and told my mother, we actually made a phone call to my grandmother that night and talked for the first time after being separated for 66 years. And within about 2 weeks, we had flown to California to meet her.
I'm wondering about your first phone call to your grandmother, your mother's mother, obviously.
Right.
How did that call? It must have been just a lightning bolt out of nowhere.
It was, except for when I had finally figured out where she lived, and I didn't even at that time know that it was the right Leona that I was looking for. I had sent her a letter, and she wrote me back and said that, yes, she would be interested in getting to know my mother.
You had the right person.
I knew I had the right person.
How did you find her?
Well, this is pre-computer days, pre-DNA days. And so I knew that she was born in 1907 or 1908, my grandmother, and from some of the documents that we had. And we knew from a Wasserman blood test that her first name was Leona, and my mother's name before she was adopted, her last name was Hendrickson. So put two and two together, we knew her name was Leona Hendrickson. I started looking for Hendrickson in the 1910 census, and after searching through all of the counties in Kansas, I finally came across Montgomery County, who had the last name Hendrickson, and they had a little girl who was 3 years old who was listed as Ona. Still didn't know if I was right, so I went to the 1915 census, which was the last census that was available at that time, and found them again, and this time they had a daughter who was 8 years old named Leona. And it was through calling down to Havana, Kansas, and just, like I said, some divine intervention, several people led me to the phone number and the address for Leona.
You know, your grandmother had a promise not to go looking for her child when she arrived at the Willows and was about to give birth. I can't help but wonder, did she ever go looking for her?
She never did. She had, when they left the Willows at that time in the early days, they were told they were not to look for their babies, to carry on with their life, to be able to put this behind them, basically. And it's not something that was easy for her to do, but she never did look for my mother. And she also, when she got married, she told her husband, her future husband, that she had had this baby, which she was told not to tell anybody, but she felt she had to. And he said that was fine, but she also told him that if she couldn't have my mother, her baby, Marcia, that she didn't want to have any other children. And she never did.
You know, the Willows wasn't the only maternity sanitarium in Kansas City. How many were there, Kelly?
There were innumerable. And I really didn't know anything about Kansas City being the adoption hub of America.
Nor did I.
Until I started to do more research about the Willows. When I was writing my first book, the person who was helping me edit the book said, "Do you really know very much about the Willows?" And I said, "I don't really know. I just sort of assumed that it was a home where maybe some people took in some girls. And little did I know that it was a large facility that could hold up to 100 girls at one time in its lifetime when it was opened between 1905 to 1969.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of other facilities that were also conveniently located by the Union Station, made it easy for the girls to get from the trains to the facilities. But I've been researching since then some of the other facilities that have been there, such as, well, there was the Fairmount, Florence Crittenden, and then the one called the Vale, which was a very shady institution.
These places, Kelly, existed. Why?
Well, in that time, it was a really difficult situation for a young girl to be pregnant and unmarried. Society did not accept them.
You were ostracized.
This
is a black mark on you forever.
Right. And also on the babies, because the young children being raised without having a marriage could be very devastating. A lot of the young women would be basically destitute for the rest of their lives. So this was a solution for them. Adoption or abortion was not acceptable in that time, though it was in the back alleys where it would happen, and a lot of young women did have abortions and died from those. But these buildings came about, or these facilities came about, to try to provide some help for these young girls, and the Willows was one of them.
In your grandmother's case, again, in Leona's case, she became pregnant by the son of a wealthy man down in Independence who asked around and heard about the Willows, actually took your mother and her brother to the train station, put them on the train, and off they went to Kansas City. Now, this was a young girl from rural Kansas who had never been outside of Independence before. This whole idea of going off to give birth to a strange place without mom and dad was simply terrifying.
It was. It was just pretty devastating. That's one of the things she did tell us, was it was a very difficult time for her, a time she would never, ever forget. But she did say that the people at the Willows treated her with utmost respect and with real dignity, and they were very kind to her. So that was always good for me to know that she was treated that well.
You know, I want to talk a little bit more. When she got in the car, a Model T, I think, to go to the train station in Independence, she became ill. And this was a really fancy car.
Right.
The father of the boy wasn't all that kind. It was just sort of going through the motions here to get this problem taken off his plate. And Leona became ill and had to stop the car and get out and throw up breakfast.
Right. And we always kind of chuckled about that when my mom and her met, because my mother always had problems with being car sick.
Oh, you're
and
kidding.
So the two of them always kind of chuckled about that incident, that she went through this as well. Didn't know whether it was being car sick nor because she had morning sickness in the situation. Also extremely nervous. But yeah, it would have been a devastating time for her to ride in that car to the train station and get on that train and come to Kansas City and then come to the Union Station.
I was going to say, she's on the train, she comes to Union Station. This is the grandest building mm-hmm. by far that she's ever seen in her life. And she gets off the train and is, you know, goes into the station like so many people did back then, and is simply overwhelmed by what she sees.
It truly was. She just was so overwhelmed by it. I write in the book a little bit about that and how it just had to have been just so incredible to be a young farm girl like that, to walk into that big mammoth building and see this throng of humanity and just feel so lost and know that she's going to be in seclusion for the next 3 or 4 months until yeah. she has the baby. And then they brought her back to the train station by herself, and she rode by the train home without her baby.
Man, just an amazing story. So she gets through Union Station with her brother. Mm-hmm. They are told to meet a nurse. I forget her name. The nurse...
It's Mrs. Reed.
Mrs. Reed, Nurse mm-hmm. Reed. And they find her. They hop in a taxi cab, and they go to the Willows, which is... This was one of the most interesting parts of all this. They basically go up Main Street, and they right. do a little U-turn at the top where Main and Grand sort of converge.
Right.
And there was the Willows mm-hmm. Sitting there after this short ride. If you would, just read a short paragraph from your book that describes what it was like for Leona to arrive at the Willows and walk up the grand staircase.
Sure, there. Be glad to. Leona felt disoriented, and everything seemed a blur. All seemed to be happening so fast. Nurse Reed was being cordial, but very businesslike, as she paid the fare to the taxi driver. He jumped out and came around to open their door. The two got out of the taxi, and Leona looked up the stair steps going up to an enormous red brick building, partially hidden behind large trees. Leona would never forget the long climb from the street up the steep steps on the hillside. She carried her meager possessions toward the ominous mansion sitting on the hill. At the top of the steps that seemed to go on forever was the entrance with the beautiful wooden column pergola. A sign read, "The Willows Hospital." Rose vines blanketed the pergola, providing shade in the summer and protection from the cold in the winter. It gave her an eerie feeling as if walking into a whole new world. Girls often felt as if they were walking in a tunnel as they approached the front door, the brick building, and the huge ornate pillars on each side of the stairs leading to the wooden door. Leona never saw anything so grand as the Willows. Not even the rich banker's house back home could compare. This would be Leona's secluded home for the next several months. She climbed the steps with Nurse Reed and entered the building, feeling completely overwhelmed in this new world.
Man, I just can't imagine. The Willows is no longer there.
It's no longer there, right. It was sold in 1969. The same family, the Haworth family, owned the Willows the entire time that it was in operation. And they sold it, and then it was torn down. And when I actually went to go look for it in the 90s, it was a Residence Inn.
Oh, is that right?
Right.
This is where Hallmark is now?
Hallmark actually bought the facility. It's north of Crown Center. I mean, mm-hmm. south of Crown Center, right off of Main Street. There's apartment complexes there now.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about a new book, Mansion on a Hill. It's a story about the Willows Maternity Sanitarium here in Kansas City back in the 20s through the 60s. All the young women from around the country who went there, Kansas City known at the time as the adoption hub of America. I gather your grandmother told you this story in lots of interviews with you.
It really wasn't much as interviews as just reading stories that she had written to my mother. One of the things that my first book came about because when my mother had passed away, I found hundreds of letters that my grandmother had written to my mother. And I had read these, and I'm finding
this
things
after
out.
They were
after they both had passed away.
After they were reunited.
Yes, after they were reunited. Mm-hmm. There's 13 years that they actually got to spend together. So my grandmother was 96 when she passed away.
And but she detailed all of this in these letters.
She detailed a lot of information, things that I didn't know. And so there were things that I would tell friends, and they started telling me, you need to write this down. I never intended to write a book, but that's how it came about because I started to learn more things that I didn't know before.
Bill Benson has tweeted us this morning. My great-grandmother ran the Willows. Great stories, he says. Thanks for keeping these stories alive. Tell us about the family who ran this home and why they did it.
I find that just really incredible.
Yes, it is incredible.
E.P. Haworth and his wife Cora May started the Willows in 1905, and they actually started it in their own home. And they started by having a friend who had a daughter who became pregnant, and they were going to send her off. And they said, why don't you let her stay with us? We will keep her and we will help place the baby for adoption and keep this out of society's eye. And that sort of became their mission and just grew from there. They felt that this was their mission in life. And one of the things that made it a little different than the other facilities was that it was a private institution mm-hmm. where the same family owned it. They didn't take money from any other outside organizations or philanthropy or anything. It was all based on the money that came in from the girls staying there. So they could control who came in. They didn't have anyone telling them what they needed to do or how they could do it.
The Willows was considered maybe the nicest of these yes. maternity sanitariums around town,
right.
known as the Waldorf of right. these kinds of sanitariums.
Right.
Why was it, what made it so nice?
Well, part of the reason was they made sure that they tried to keep it up to date. It was always remodeled and it was very expensive to live there. They made no bones about it. They didn't take just anybody. And it was more for, I would say, more for high society people. Mm-hmm. My grandmother probably wouldn't have gotten to stay there if she hadn't had this rich farmer who was able to pay for her way to go there to get rid of this indiscretion.
I was going to say, to wipe the slate
right,
clean for
exactly.
his son. Knowing that the adoption records in Missouri were so tight, so closed down, that no one would ever find out that his son had, in fact, had been the father.
Right, exactly. If my mother had been born in Kansas, she would have been able to have gotten her original birth certificate because Kansas has open records, whereas Missouri has had closed records up until about 3 or 4 years ago. And so my mother was never able to get her original birth certificate, which would have had her birth mother's mm-hmm. name and possibly the birth father's name on it. Sometimes they didn't have the father's name.
What did she say, Leona, about how this incident had changed her reputation back in Independence and later in her life? Did she get away with it? Was it a secret or did word get out?
It was really a secret. In
no kidding.
Fact, when we went to go meet her and I had written the letter, we said, we don't want to interfere in your life. We just would like to meet you. And she, when she got my first letter, she actually contacted a niece that she had lived with when she had moved out of the Willows back home. She stayed with her sister. Her niece was 5 or 6 years old. She wrote her niece and or called her and asked her, what do you think? My daughter has asked if she'd like to meet me.
Wow.
Her niece did not know that she'd ever had a baby.
Oh, you're kidding.
So the entire family, except for her brother, were the only one, he was the only one who knew that she'd had a baby. So it was a very well-kept secret.
And that was the process that some families
yes.
employed back in those days to keep the reputation of their families
right.
Above repute here, I
right.
guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They would say they were sent to go stay with family or they'd go to work for a while or maybe go to school to cover up this indiscretion and then they would come back home and pretend as if it had never happened.
So how did your grandmother spend the rest of her life?
My grandmother ended up getting married when she was about, I think she was 19, 18,
just a few 19, years later.
A few
yeah.
years later. It was in the time of the Depression. So she and her husband moved to Klamath Falls, Oregon. And she and her husband helped to build the roads up to Crater Lake. Mm-hmm. Very difficult life that they led. And they also often talked about the fact that it would have been really difficult to have had a baby and raised a baby in that time period. Mm. And one of the things my mother and her always said to one another was, she was so appreciative that my grandmother had enough love for her to give her up and that she had the wonderful life that she did because my mother had wonderful family that she grew up in.
Just briefly, Kelly, Kansas City became known as the adoption hub of America because so many train lines converged
right.
in Kansas City, mm-hmm. the central location of the city. When did Kansas City begin to lose its reputation as the adoption hub of America?
Really around in the latter 60s,
mm-hmm.
Things started to change as far as the Roe versus Wade. You had the whole movement where love and peace, and it was a little more acceptable in society. Girls weren't ostracized as much if they were pregnant. A lot of girls were starting to keep their babies, and it just wasn't as negative. The Willows closed primarily because Mrs. Haworth's daughter-in-law began ranting it in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
She was getting elderly and was ready to close it down, you know, to retire. And the numbers of girls coming in that they needed to be able to keep it going was dropping.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. That's Kelly Parr. Again, his book, Mansion on a Hill. And boy, I sure enjoyed talking to you. It's an amazing
Thank
story.
You.
One of those forgotten stories that you've been able to resurrect here.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kelly. Mm-hmm. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Monday, a preview of the upcoming Missouri General Assembly session. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.